down and started this morning. The approach we want to take is around the corner. We're looking at history, of course. The period, as I mentioned in the intro last Sunday, also intertwined in that are some spiritual truths, some of the significant lessons that we glean from these prophets especially. Some of the things that are key to us, as well as some of the stories that we're going to see as we go through. So this morning, we're going to start out and look at some key historical events. Look at two excerpts from this period of Jeremiah. We can look at many. We're going to look at two. One thing you'll note, one deviation, I'm going to leave the intro to Ezekiel to Trevor. He's really covering that Wednesday night. So I'm not going to introduce Ezekiel today except to say that he was carried into captivity. And Trevor will pick up Ezekiel from that point Wednesday night. This morning I want to take a look also at the significance of the prophecy concerning Coniah, or Jehoiakim, or Jeconiah, known by all three names. A very significant passage in the book of Jeremiah. So we want to focus on that a little bit this morning as well. And then talk about my favorite story in the entire Old Testament. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And I was cautioned not to tell this group the story the way I tell it to my grandchildren. Although that's probably the best way to tell the story, right? With a lot of passion, a lot of gusto, but great story. So we'll wrap up our study this morning in Daniel chapter 3, looking at Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But again, we'll look at some of the historical facts of this period. Here's the only map we'll look at this morning. Certainly three key dates. By now, we should have those fairly well ingrained in our minds, even from your prior studies. Jeremiah 29:10 speaks of the 70 years in captivity, and that's, of course, the prophecy that Daniel read later on. We'll cover that later in the quarter. So these dates here are very significant, as you have three phases of the carrying away into captivity. And again, if you're depending on what study you do, it may be 1 year different, 605, 606, or 597, 598. Don't be too concerned about that 1 year difference. And so here is the map, so we can see that's the geography we're talking about. We come first to Jehoiakim. We talked about this a little bit before. Placed on the throne by Pharaoh Necho. Pharaoh from what country? All right, up from Egypt. In about 609, but really for a very short period of time. Now, this morning we'll be in 2 Kings 23, 24 most of the time. It's a reference to 2 Chronicles. But for the most part, for this section, it'll be 2 Kings chapter 24. But after a brief period of time, Pharaoh, his army is overtaken. You remember the army of Babylon? They come in and you get the battle. Egypt comes up to help the Assyrians as they try to hold off the Babylonian Empire. They're not successful at doing that. So there we find that Nebuchadnezzar really gains control of the world. His empire is really established. Egypt goes back to Egypt. Did King Nebuchadnezzar ever conquer Egypt? No, did not. As we intro last week, really only one nation that really ever did that, and that was Persia. Now, Persia's empire was very expansive, as we saw last week. So Egypt was never really conquered by Babylon. They went back home. And so he subjected Nebuchadnezzar, and after the defeat, there in 605, the first captives are taken into Babylonian captivity. Also during this period of time, this is an interesting passage, 2 Kings 24, 1 through 3. They were raided by the Moabites, the Ammonites, those nations that you studied in prior quarters, mainly across the Jordan River. What's interesting about this passage is a very distinct statement. Recall last week, we said in this period of history there are some very key lessons that we learned. One of those is that God is in control of the nations. God is in control of the nations. A very key lesson for this quarter and study of this part of the Bible. You notice this very distinct statement. The Lord sent against him bands of the Chaldees. Surely at the commandment of the Lord came this upon Judah. There's no question as you look at the Old Testament, even coming to Romans 13:1, as we mentioned briefly last week, that God is in control of the nations. We'll see this again this morning as we come to one of Jeremiah's prophecies in Jeremiah chapter 51 concerning the nation of Babylon. Why do you think this is important for us as God's people to even contemplate and emphasize the fact that God's in control? He's in control today. What can that do for you? Now, Craig, as you watch the world news, what can this knowledge do for you? Have peace of mind, right? Whatever happens, God is in control. And all of the time, myself included, we watch the news, we get a little bit concerned about this and that happening in the world. But it will bring solace to us if we realize that God is in control. Romans 13, verse 1 says what? The powers that be are what? Ordained of God. So that's one key reason why we remind ourselves of that. And we'll also see a passage later in Jeremiah 51 with another reason. It really speaks of the power of God. It helps us more appreciate the power of God. Because He brought the earth into being. He raised up nations. God controls the nations of the world. And so we have to stand in all of the power of God. So we put this in here. It's a period. It's a point of history, which is significant. But of more significance to us, it reemphasizes this point that God is in control. So here is Jehoiakim. Obviously, all these last kings, really puppet kings, all of them are. Because Pharaoh puts one on the throne. He reigns. Nebuchadnezzar now puts someone on the throne. Really, they don't have a lot of power because they're under rule of either Egypt or Babylon. Now, Jehoiakim, also known as Jeconiah or Coniah, we'll study a little bit later about this in Jeremiah. The records tell us that Jehoiakim died on December 7th, 598, not 1958. Carla was awake. She caught me on that one. All right, so she's going to keep me honest this morning. I'll share something briefly with you. Most of you know Sister Lee, Urban Lee and his wife. I was teaching adult class at Jackson Drive years ago. And Sister Lee is a very astute Bible student, as you know. And studying the Old Testament, and she was sitting on the second row back with Brother Lee. And if I said something right, if I said something, she'd nod. She'd always nod. So one morning on the way out, I said, Sister Lee, I said, I appreciate you helping teach class this morning. She said, oh, Brother Curry, what do you mean? And I told her. I was always on my toes with her in a class. All right. So we've got Jehoiakim. He's placed on the throne by Nebuchadnezzar. He really had taken captive in 597. What's significant about 597 then when this happens? He then goes into captivity. Him and his mother, as was prophesied. We don't have time to back up and notice all the prophecies, but in your study, if you go back and run some cross-references, you find a number of things happening in this period of time that especially Jeremiah or another of the prophets have prophesied ahead of time. Now, we notice here, we'll look at this a little bit later too, the elite class was taken captive, and the poorest of the land left behind, some 10,000. But all the princes, the craftsmen, even some men of war taken captive, and the poor were left behind during this phase of captivity. We'll see that again in 586. And my only mention to Ezekiel this morning is that he's taken captive during this group, and Trevor will pick up the rest about Ezekiel Wednesday evening. But we've got Jehoiakim and Jehoiakim. The next king after this, we got Zedekiah. Truly a puppet and placed on his throne by King Nebuchadnezzar, 597. Interrupted, he reigned 11 years until the fall of Jerusalem in 586. So Zedekiah really becomes the last king. We know that one was placed in the land, Gedaliah, as a governor after 586, but really as a king, we find there are no more. All right? So these are really the three kings, some of the significant facts. Not a whole lot happened during this period of time, except they are controlled by Egypt and then by Babylon. I want to look at a couple things from Jeremiah. I mentioned before in 597, 2 Kings 24, when the captives were taken, only the poor left behind. We're not really told. What's your supposition? Why do you think that's so? Why would a craftsman be taken? Why would the poor be left behind? All right? We know that Nebuchadnezzar was looking to benefit, right? Even with Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, their new names, we find that they were taken to do service in the court of King Nebuchadnezzar. So he took the very best back to benefit Babylon. Babylon was a very technically advanced culture. And so Nebuchadnezzar was looking to, I think, to bring those skills back to Babylon. And I think Trevor makes a valid point. Scripture doesn't tell us that. There'd be very little means left to rebel because they had no financial means to do so. So we see that again in 586 B.C., a statement there in 2 Kings 25:12. It said they'd be left as the vine dressers. And so we find that this was stated. Now what's interesting is, if you turn to Jeremiah 24, so if you live in Judah at this period of time, and you see a lot of folks taken captive, you see them herded up, and you see the Babylonian army lead them away, and you stay behind. What might your thought be, Jimmy, if you got to stay behind?
I'm not sure of anything.
I think I would be too. I said, man, I'm lucky because I got to stay behind and they were taken. And so it's interesting that Jeremiah dispels that here in Jeremiah 24, 1 through 10. It appears to be a vision. God showed him. It may have been a vision. Doesn't use the word vision. But here are the figs. He saw some good figs that were good to eat and some figs that were very bad. And the language is very emphatic. Some very good figs and some very bad figs. The bad figs were so that you couldn't eat the figs. And as you look at that vision there in Jeremiah 24, Jeremiah says the lucky figs are the ones that were carried into captivity. And as you look at the text there in Jeremiah 24, the key reason they were lucky ones was that God was not going to forsake them. God would continue to be with them. And that was a blessing that those who went into captivity would enjoy. Because here again, Jeremiah 29:10, the captivity does not last forever. God has said that. Now, do you think most people who went captive even knew about that statement by Jeremiah 29? Had Jeremiah tried to talk to them? He tried his best, didn't he? He tried to talk to them, but they didn't listen to Jeremiah. So I would doubt that very, very few of those who went into captivity could really appreciate the fact that it might come to an end. But here Jeremiah says that the good figs are those who were carried away because God has not forgotten them. And so from that standpoint, they would continue to be God's chosen who would come back from captivity. But the Jews remained, a statement there says they'll be tossed among the nations. They'll be a reproach. And it says they'll finally disappear. And so an interesting comment here from Jeremiah relative to the state of those who were left behind in Judah. Another interesting passage, Jeremiah 51. If you turn to Jeremiah 51 for a moment, it's one I referenced earlier this morning. There's some very clear statements made here. I'm just going to pick up a couple. Jeremiah 51, verse 1, thus saith Jehovah, behold, I will raise up against Babylon a destroying wind. Verse 5, for Israel is not forsaken, nor Judah of his God, a Jehovah of hosts, though their land is full of guilt against the Holy One of Israel. God does not absolve Israel of their guilt and the reason he took them into captivity, but he says they are not forsaken. Verse 7, notice how God has used Babylon. Babylon hath been a golden cup in Jehovah's hand that made all the earth drunk, and the nations have drunk of her wine. Therefore the nations are mad. Babylon is suddenly fallen and destroyed, all at the hand of God. Verse 15, he hath made the earth by his power. He hath established the world by his wisdom, and by his understanding hath he stretched out the heavens. There's a reminder that Jeremiah provides them to us of the power of God. Verse 20, thou art my battle axe and weapons of war, and with thee will I break in pieces the nations, and with thee will I destroy kingdoms. Remember Jeremiah chapter 18, beginning verse 1? Jeremiah uses what illustration to talk about how God can mold and shape kingdoms? What's the potter's house? A very key passage. Jeremiah 18 is one that all of us ought to be very, very familiar with, because even your younger classes, they can certainly understand that and appreciate the great lessons that's taught there in Jeremiah chapter 18. Just a couple more verses here. Verse 47. Therefore, behold, the day has come that I will execute judgment upon the graven image of Babylon. 49, as Babylon hath caused the slain of Israel to fall, so of Babylon shall fall the slain of all the land. The last verse, verse 53. Though Babylon should mount up to heaven, And though she should fortify the height of her strength, yet from me shall destroyers come unto her, saith Jehovah. God is in control. What other book starts like this? One of the minor prophets. Remember that minor prophet, a short one chapter book? Obadiah, all right, with Edom. Very, very, almost identical language. Though she mount up on a high place as an eagle, yet I will bring her down from thence. So it's interesting as you look at that, almost the identical language. So it doesn't matter how mighty a nation thinks that she might be or actually becomes, in man's terms, God is still in control and God can bring down any nation. Except the United States, right? You agree, Larry? The U.S. is sort of quarantined. We're like Job. God's built a wall around the U.S. All right. So we caution ourselves, right? It's valuable any time that you have an opportunity to go outside this country and travel and meet with Christians in other parts of the world. It's valuable experience. You'll come back recognizing that New Testament Christianity is not a U.S. Christianity. Because we're born and raised here, we sort of naturally grow up with that mentality. But that sort of brings it home. So the U.S. is no different than any other nation in the world down to the ages of time. Alright, so now, as you come down to the latter part of that, I've raised a couple of verses. Verse 51, he says, I will raise up against Babylon. Verse 11, I didn't read that verse, talks about the Medes. But we know from Daniel 2 that God raised up the Medo-Persians, and they were his instruments to bring judgment upon Babylon. There we see Jeremiah 18 executed. He raised up Babylon, now he raised up Medes and the Persians. They overtake Babylon. Now, Sariah went with Zedekiah to Babylon and with instructions. He said, you take these words that I've spoken about Babylon, the fact you're going to fall, and you go speak these words. And he says, when you finish reading these, when thou hast made an end of reading this book, thou shalt bind a stone to it and cast it in the midst of the Euphrates. And you continue on reading there, verse 54, Babylon will not rise again. So chapter 51 is a very distinct a pronunciation of God's judgment against Babylon. And he gives this instruction through Jeremiah, to you go and you deliver this message. I want this message to be taken. All right, a comment on this, observation?
The reason for the judgment is because of their idolatry. Interesting that Gentiles are expected to worship the true God in the Old Testament.
All right, a key observation for many, many reasons, even as we think about the gospel today. You think about some laws of gospel. Think, people have the idea that if you're not a Christian, you're not amenable to God's law. Valid point. Even at this day and time, today, always been the case. And embedded in that is a statement that he's going to bring judgment against the Baal of Babylon. So the judgment came against the idols. All right, I want to spend a few minutes on this. Most of the people that you live next to and will ever study the Bible with, the vast majority are premillennial. Now, premillennial simply means that we're living in an age before the thousand-year reign of Christ on earth. As we go through the quarter, we'll come back and revisit this a couple of times. But the view is that Christ is going to return, and he's going to set up a literal throne in Judah, and he's going to reign a literal thousand years in Judah. That's one of the very basic tenets of premillennialism. There will be a physical throne in Judah. Well, now, if you think about that basic tenet of the premillennial theory, this becomes very important. Now, 2 Samuel 7. Matt, turn and read that. Oh, I'm sorry. You got your hand. I'm sorry. Hey, Jimmy, turn to 2 Samuel 7. Read 12 and 13. I forgot he had a little one there, though. I saw the child's book pop up there. Here's a passage that... As we leave this study today, if you are not very, very familiar with these two passages right here, if you are very familiar with how they're coupled together, I would encourage you to go home and study until you're very comfortable with that. Because these are two key verses right here. All right, Jimmy?
In thy days be fulfilled, and thy sleep with thy father, I will set up thy seed after thee, God of the valley, and I will be forever.
All right, who is he talking to in that text? He's talking to David. So if we look at what's being said here, he's talking to David. And what's the subject? He said what's the subject of conversation here? You're not going to do it. But he said, there's coming a time when I'm going to do what? He says, I'm going to raise up someone of your seed, right? What does that mean? I'm going to raise up someone out of your seed. His descendant. Is that simple? That means that that in the genealogy of David, one's going to be raised up to fulfill this prophecy. Now, does Samuel tell us who that is? No, Samuel doesn't say that. But there is a very clear prophecy here that of the seed of David, one will be raised up, and actually it's going to be raised up to sit on the throne of David. Not just one raised up, would be raised up as king, as one who would rule. So these are the key facts that we must take away from 2 Samuel chapter 7. Not real difficult to glean, especially if you back up and read some of the verses prior to that. Now, another key lesson is anytime you study the Bible, whenever you have a prophecy, at some point in time later, there is a very, very clear fulfillment of that prophecy. What does that tell you? What does it mean to you? Right? What if there's one prophecy, Bill Moreau, that you could find that had been fulfilled? Just one.
Doubts.
You would have doubts. Exactly right. So key lesson I didn't mention last week, but certainly recognize, is any time we see a prophecy in the Old Testament, or any time, and we see a clear fulfillment later on. Now in our studies, we see some prophecies that have fulfillments. Sometimes it's a little bit difficult to know exactly, is this what was being mentioned by the prophet? Sometimes, very simple, right? Acts 2, day of Pentecost. Peter says, what does he say? This is that which was what, Joe? Spoken by the prophet Joel. So sometimes there's such a clear statement, you can't miss the fact that this happening, this occurrence right now, is exactly what Joel 2, verse 28 beginning was talking about. Very clear. Now, this is clear. This is a good example of this. And as we look at the premillennial doctrine, if you study with friends, and this question comes up, and it will, if you study with very many folks, the premillennial thoughts are going to surface. I had a discussion at a boat manufacturer in Missouri 2 months ago. A fellow there, we sat at dinner table. Guess what the discussion was? The premillennial theory. The basic tenets of John Luther's beliefs. So if you study with people, these are going to surface because we're at the very heart of what most people who are in a building somewhere around the country today believe and teach. Now, if you look at Acts 2, a passage that we're familiar with, beginning verse 29, he simply makes a statement, I may say unto you freely of the patriarch David that he died and was buried in his tomb and is with us this day. Being therefore a prophet and knowing that God has sworn with an oath to him that of the fruit of his loins he would set one upon his throne. All right, there's a connection we're looking for. All right, one of his descendants. Now notice a clear statement. He foreseeing this spake of the resurrection of the Christ, that neither was he left unto Hades, nor did his flesh see corruption. This Jesus did God raise up, whereof we are all witnesses, being therefore of the right hand of God exalted, and having received of the Father the promise of the Holy Spirit, he hath poured forth this which ye see and hear. For David ascended not into heaven, but he saith unto himself, the Lord said unto my Lord, sit down my right hand till I make thine enemies a footstool of thy feet. So here's a clear fulfillment of this passage. So as we look at the prophecy then concerning Coniah, here's a promise made that one would come in the future of the seed of David and would reign upon a throne. But then what? Notice now in Jeremiah 22, a very clear statement made about Coniah or Jeconiah. Jeremiah 22, beginning verse 24. Now, Larry Wisdom, read verses 24 through 30, please. Jeremiah 22. Now, bear in mind what we just read, 2 Samuel 7 and Acts 2. Now, here's a king. Notice what's said, Larry.
24 through 30.
Yes.
For I said to the Lord, I am the son of Jacoboam, king of the signet upon my right hand, yet will I put thee thence. Give thee the hand of life, and the hand of the hearest. Even I will the hand of out of my mother that bare thee into the land whereunto they desire to return. By I despise thy vessel wherein is the pleasure, for if thou cast out God, he is the seed destined to be away and say no not. O earth, 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 hear the word of the Lord. Thus saith the Lord, write to this man childless, the man that shall prosper in his day, for no man of his seed prosper save upon
the. Now look at the last two phrases. You've got two things that are stated. It says, a man shall not prosper of this seed, that is the seed of David, sitting upon the throne of David. But it doesn't end right there, does it? What's the last statement say, Trenton? And ruling in Judah. Now, what's significant about that? As you think about the premillennial doctrine that Jesus is going to return and reign in Jerusalem. What's significant about that? Why is that, Jimmy? That's about as plain as you can say it, right? It's not going to happen. Why is that? It says it's not going to happen. Even though Jimmy's been out in the hot sun this week mowing, probably. Even though that, this morning, he still knows. Bring a little bit at him. He can see that, right? So this is a very, very key passage here. A very clear statement. And so that's why I wanted to bring this out this morning as we think about this particular passage. You can take these three verses right here and you can dispute that theory. Now also coupled with that, John 18:36, during the trial of Jesus, he says, what about his kingdom? My kingdom is not of this world. And so if you add that passage, we know that Jesus did not come to establish a physical kingdom. Never was a plan, never was the intent. So this is sort of a learning for this class period this morning. I think very important to us. Okay, now let's go to my favorite story in the Old Testament. Daniel chapter 3. For those teaching next quarter, teaching children, I'll be glad to be a guest teacher and come in and teach. This is a great story. This is one that you can do so much with. And I would have left more time with it this morning, except most of us are very familiar with this particular story. Now, Daniel 3 begins with jealousy. Jealousy on the part of whom?
Advisors.
Nebuchadnezzar advisors. Why would they be jealous, James? All right, very clearly stated, right? And so a great lesson about jealousy. Can we understand that? Oh, absolutely. Odds are, if you're working, sometime in your career, somebody will be come in. You've been there, they're going to come in and put you right on top. I work with a client now. I didn't agree with what they did, but they merged two companies. And they took all the management on this one and put it right on top, this other company. Now they got to work together. And so you get the same sense of a feeling, right? That, wow, we've sort of been overlooked, been forgotten. And that's exactly how Daniel 3 opens up right here. So we know that the story begins with a golden image that was built 90 feet tall, 9 feet wide. And what decree did the king make at what point in time? When the music plays, you bow down and worship. All right? If you don't bow down and worship, what did the decree say? You think the king Nebuchadnezzar was serious about that? You think the people took him seriously? Absolutely. Unlike our system today, there was no due process. You wouldn't stay on death row for 25 years while King Nebuchadnezzar decided if he was going to fulfill that decree or not. Now, that just wouldn't happen. So they knew that he was serious about it. And so they were very ready to comply. Now, as we come down to verses 8 through 12 here in Daniel chapter 3, here's the accusation. If you ever need a real easy sermon, that's a great sermon, you're going to have an outline this morning in just a minute. It's a very, very powerful sermon. A way you can break it down here. So the accusation comes, verses 8 through 12. They brought the accusation against the Jews. Verse 8, thou hast made a decree. The king makes a decree. You've got to follow through on it. But now you've brought these men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They serve not thy gods, and worship the golden image thou hast set up. So here's the accusation. Was it a true accusation, Trenton? Absolutely. So the accusation is given. There are these Jews that will not comply with the decree you made. Now verses 13 through 15, their faith is challenged. Verse 13, don't miss this when you teach this. Nebuchadnezzar in his rage and fury commanded to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and brought before the king. We can't even begin to imagine what that'd be like. Today to be brought before our president wouldn't even begin to compare to this. So here, they're brought before the king. Verse 14. O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that ye serve not my God, nor worship the golden image which I have set up. He said, I want to give you a chance. Verse 15. But if you worship not, you shall be cast the same hour in the midst of a burning, fiery furnace. There in verse 15. Now, what great question does King Nebuchadnezzar ask then, Daniel? Alright? Alright, in the latter part of verse 15, what question did King Nebuchadnezzar ask? Here's a pompous King Nebuchadnezzar, right? We know he's pompous because God later, as we'll study, turns him into an animal walking around eating grass. So here's a man that's very pompous, most powerful man in the world. He said, "Who is it that can deliver you out of my hand?" And now we find that the faith is challenged. Now we find that there, if technology works, maybe not. Next page. Oh, here it is. All right. Faith is declared. Verses 16, 17, and 18. Daniel, read that for us, please.
Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to him, "We have no need to answer you. If that is the case, our God whom we serve will fire the burning fiery furnace, deliver us from your hand, not that we know we must serve your God."
Now, what's powerful about the statement in verse 16, Bill? Yeah, King, it should be evident. You should know. You should know, right? As we declare our faith, do we declare our faith once a time in our lifetime? No, continually. People who know us and know of us, they should know where we stand. They shouldn't even have to ask. I don't need to ask Larry. Larry, Sunday night, do you plan to go to services tonight, Larry? Larry could say what? Well, Jerry, I don't need to give you an answer. You know Sunday night I'm going to be here, right? And that's the statement right here. Kingdom of God, you know who we are. Now, let me ask you this question. What two Old Testament commands would they violate by doing this? One and two. What's the first one? Alright, so there are two commands. When you study this with your classes, you need to remind them of, here are two clear Old Testament commands. Thou shalt have no other God before me, shall not make yourself any graven images, nor bow down unto them. So they had no choice in the matter. If they're going to serve God, they simply could not do that. And that is exactly why. So we find that they have now declared their faith. Be it known, our God will deliver us, but even if he does not. That's an interesting statement, isn't it? We can be victorious and still lose our physical life. Right? Antipas, one of, I think, the greatest characters in the entire Bible, Revelation, mentioned by one time, my faithful servant Antipas. He was put to death, and yet he was victorious. And the same mindset here with these three young men. Our God will deliver, but even if he does not deliver us out of the fire, we're still not going to bow down and worship this image. So they declare their faith. Now their faith is tested. It was challenged before. They were told, if you don't bow down, I'm going to throw you in the fiery furnace. Not that they doubted it, but now it's brought to their doorstep. When we walk through life, temptation may be brought to our doorstep. You probably don't have to go back even to yesterday or this week. Think in your mind of a temptation. It was brought to your doorstep, right? Literally. It's ever present before us. Same thing these three young men face. Now their faith is tested. Verses 19 through 23, they heat the furnace up 7 times hotter than normal and cast them into the burning fiery furnace. So hot that it slew the men who were carrying them up. And here's where there's some animation that when you teach young children, such a powerful story here. And so King Nebuchadnezzar did exactly what he said he was going to do, and his faith was tested. James talks about a trial by fire. Here's a literal trial by fire. Do you think they were afraid? I would suspect so. Faith helps us overcome fear, but it doesn't mean that you're not afraid. There's the furnace. And so here we find their faith is tested. Now, next thing we see is that their faith is victorious. We've read this, verses 24 through 27. What does King Nebuchadnezzar see that astonished him when he looked in the furnace? Four instead of three. All right. What about all of them? Were they still bound up? Hands were loosened. So certainly that would be a matter of astonishment as he sees this occur. Now, what I do find interesting is, when he sees that, what does he tell them to do? Bring them out. Of course, they bring them out, and what a powerful point. What's two notable things are pointed out about them when they come out? Hair was not singed, not a smell of smoke on their bodies. Now for them, I would say that they were victorious. Their faith was victorious for them personally. But you can live your life and you can be faithful to yourself and you can have a victory. But let me suggest, as another point, is our faith can also be triumphant. Our faith is triumphant when by our faith we influence other people. Faith is triumphant. When others see God in us, when they see us living faithfully and we influence them, then I think our faith is truly triumphant as we influence others. King Nebuchadnezzar then makes a decree that everybody in all places are going to bow down. You're going to serve the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. What a great triumph of faith. We start first of all with our children, right? And our grandchildren. We want that triumph of faith. We want our children to be faithful. We want our grandchildren to be faithful. Our great-grandchildren. Our friends, family. And our faith is triumphant when we influence others to serve God faithfully. All right. Final comment. Very good. Trevor has his questions. Lesson 4. With the magic of technology, this should now be downloaded. We're doing it on a timely basis. Not to my credit, but to Trevor's. I'd also point out something else. The course syllabus schedule, everybody has one. That's Trevor's work. I started out one that looked very, very weak. And Trevor spiced it up a lot and made it look very presentable. So that's his work. All right, thank you very much.